This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ إِلَّا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favour after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: North Korea fires multiple missiles, including an intercontinental ballistic one, a day after U.S. President wraps up his Asia tour. Iran says Israel's killing of a Palestinian journalist is part of the regime's war of harassment and violence to cover up its crimes. And in Texas, a mass shooting at an elementary school leaves 19 children and 2 adults dead. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. North Korea ramps up its missile tests, reportedly firing several short- and long-range projectiles in a single day amid heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. South Korea and Japan say 3 missiles, including one that appeared to be an ICBM, were fired in the early hours of Wednesday. Seoul and Tokyo have called the launch as provocative. South Korea's military says it has, in response, held a joint drill with American forces without giving any details. North Korea has conducted a flurry of missile tests, including its largest ICBM this year. The launch has happened just a day after U.S. President Joe Biden wrapped up his Asia trip, during which he agreed to new measures to deter the nuclear-armed North. A White House official says Biden has been briefed on the latest launches. Meanwhile, the South Korean defense chief has, in a phone call with his U.S. counterpart, called for an early deployment of American strategic assets in his country. Our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, explains why exactly North Korea keeps so working on its missiles technology despite all the denuclearization talks from the U.S.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un promised then-president of the United States, Donald Trump, that Pyongyang would refrain from long-range missile testing and nuclear testing so long as the U.S. dropped its hostile policy. Really, the U.S. didn't come forward with any negotiations with North Korea, kept North Korea under United Nations Security Council sanctions. North Korea then sort of gave perhaps the Biden administration a bit of time to come forward, and now with the conservative Yoon Suk-yeol government here in the South, we can see that patience really has kind of run out from the North, with analysts suggesting now North Korea really isn't going to look for any sort of denuclearization talks, but is likely to maintain a nuclear deterrence against what it sees as U.S. aggression.
Iran's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations has deplored Israel's assassination of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Zahra Ershadi said the reporter's killing was part of Israel's long-standing and well-documented war of harassment, intimidation, and violence against journalists. The Iranian diplomat said the regime targets journalists to cover up crimes that it commits against the people of Palestine. Ershadi described Abu Akleh as another victim of the international community's inaction in the face of continuous Israeli atrocities. She called on the UN and the Security Council to take urgent action to end Israel's impunity and ensure protection for the Palestinian people. Abu Akleh was fatally shot while covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin on May 11. And 1 week into the tragic death of the Palestinian journalist, Israel still refuses to accept responsibility for her killing. Another Palestinian reporter who was next to Abu Akleh when she was shot says the regime deliberately targeted her to silence journalists. In an interview with Press TV, Shahata Sanaisa dismissed claims that Israeli forces have that the veteran Al Jazeera Arabic journalist might have been hit by Palestinian fire. Anaisha says that Israeli troops killed Abu Akleh in order to stop the media coverage of the crimes that they are committing. She said that the Israelis seek to evade accountability and will not allow an independent investigation into Abu Akleh's killing. She said it is a regular thing with Israeli forces to kill Palestinians and get away with it, as nobody bothers to hold them to account. Abu Akleh was killed while covering a raid by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin earlier this month. She is widely believed to be killed by Israeli forces. The Associated Press said Tuesday its own investigation supports assertions that the bullet that killed her came from an Israeli gun. But the regime says that its own investigation has not determined that narrative, Israel says. Even if that were the case, it does not appear that the soldier who fired his gun would stand guilty of criminal conduct. Another Palestinian youth has been killed by Israeli forces following intense clashes with settlers near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Palestinian media says 16-year-old Gaither Rafael Yamin was shot in the head after hundreds of settlers stormed the tomb of Prophet Joseph near the city. Violent clashes then erupted between Palestinian youth and Israeli settlers. The Palestinian Red Crescent says over 75 people have been injured. A resistance group based in the West Bank city of Jenin says its forces have shot and injured a number of Israeli troops who accompanied the settlers. Hamas has also issued a statement blaming Israel for the escalation of tensions in the West Bank. The United States has just seen one of its deadliest school shootings in years. A gunman has killed 19 children and two adults at an elementary school in the state of Texas. The suspect has been identified as an 18-year-old man. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says the suspect is dead, apparently killed by police officers in the town. Reports say that the gunman drove up to the school and entered with a rifle and a handgun. The carnage follows a series of mass shootings in the United States this month. Despite recurring mass casualty shootings, multiple initiatives to reform gun regulations have failed in Congress, leaving states and local councils to end and to enact their own restrictions. A new report by the FBI revealed that the U.S. experienced 61 active shooter incidents in 2021, showing a sharp increase compared to 2020 and the highest tally in more than 20 years. The European Union remains split on imposing an oil embargo on Russia, with Hungary signaling that it will not back the proposal. In a letter to the EU chief, the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban said it appears unlikely that a comprehensive solution could be found before a special meeting of the EU is held later this month. Diplomatic sources say that sanctions on Russia and oil will be on the agenda during the summit. The Hungarian Prime Minister says banning Russia's oil would only deepen internal divisions and offers no realistic solution to tackle them. Hungary has already imposed a new state of emergency, citing the war in Ukraine. And the European Union calls for talks with Russia on possibilities of reviving exports of wheat and other food supplies from Ukraine.
I think this is a very complex topic, and we also need in some way some dialogue with Russia on that one. It cannot be in Russia's interest that because of Russia, people are dying of hunger in the world. And therefore, I think we should first of all look at the dialogue with Russia, whether there is not an agreement that this wheat gets out of Ukraine.
The European Commission president stressed that food supplies from Ukraine are necessary to prevent a global food crisis. Kiev says Russia has blockaded all of its ports, a claim that Moscow has rejected. On Monday, the Kremlin blamed Ukraine for making its own commercial shipping impossible by placing mines along the Black Sea coast. Ukraine is one on top when of wheat producers in the world. Kiev says it explores have fallen sharply since Russia launched the war on February 24th. The war and the West's anti-Russia measures have pushed up prices of food commodities in many countries. Iran's foreign minister says the country will use all its legal and international capacities to prosecute those involved in the assassination of the IRGC member in Tehran. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a message to the family of Colonel Hassan Sayed Khudai, who was assassinated on Sunday. He said the assassination proves that Iran is in the forefront of the fight against terrorism. Amir Abdullahian said Iran has also been a regular victim of state terrorism. The foreign minister censured the silence of certain countries and that false claim to be a fighting and terror activity. Human rights, the IRGC's top commander, Major General Hossein Salami, has vowed Iran's response will be tough and make the enemies regret the heinous crime. Iranians have marked the 40th anniversary of the liberation of the southwestern city of Khorramshahr. The occasion is marked every year as a decisive moment that changed the fate of the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. Yusuf Shadlili reports.
It's just another day in Iran's southwestern city of Khorramshahr, with a call to prayer resonating from the city's main mosque, Masjid Jame. But 40 years ago, on this day, the mosque was witness to a historic moment that changed the course of the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. It was the day when the city was recaptured from the Iraqi forces after 19 months. War veteran Abdul Saheb still recalls what he refers to as the decisive day.
The liberation of Khorramshahr was one of the greatest moments for Iran in its war with Iraq. Khorramshahr was a highly strategic city, both geographically and economically, as it was and still is a major port city with oil and gas reserves. Iraq used all its force to occupy the city, but lost to our people's resistance.
Khorramshahr was the first city that was captured by Iraq shortly after the onset of a war that took a marathon 8 years, only to end in a ceasefire, with no gains for Iraq. Then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein enjoyed full military support from the West, believing to capture Khorramshahr, only in 3 hours.
Saddam thought in vain that he would be able to take control of Khorramshahr in 3 hours, but the resistance of our brave men and women made it take 45 days to occupy only two-thirds of the city. So Saddam and his Western supporters, with all their advanced weapons, faced our people's steadfastness.
But the strategic port city of Khorramshahr was finally captured by Iraq in October 1980. After an eventful 576 days, the city was liberated in May 1982 during Operation Beit al-Muqaddas, which forced Iraqis to retreat to the border.
During Operation Beit al-Muqaddas, we entirely repulsed Iraqis from Khorramshahr. It was a heavy defeat not only for Iraq, but for the West, which stood with the aggressors. During the successful operation, we captured up to 19,000 Iraqi troops and a substantial amount of Iraqi military hardware in Khorramshahr.
Once known as the Bride of the Middle East, Khorramshahr today has turned into a symbol of resistance in Iran. While some of the bullet-riddled walls are still kept untouched, everywhere else in the city, there's a sign that reminds passersby of the May 24th resistance.
The liberation of Khorramshahr went down in history as a turning point in the Iran-Iraq war that changed the fate of the war and stopped the Iraqi forces from making further incursions into the Iranian soil. That's why Iranians still remember the decisive moment to honor those who made it happen. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Khorramshahr.
The Yemeni army says it has shot down a Saudi drone over the capital Sana'a. It says the incident is the latest violation of the UN brokered truce, which will expire in a week, amid efforts to extend it. Abdulatif Al-Bashali reports.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariyas, says the country's air defenses shot down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariyas says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
A combat drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Ruwaishan crossroad. The Saudi-led coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation Mohammed Abdusalam says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose the specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, the United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hodeidah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations.
The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
Advocates for independently owned businesses warn that restaurants, gyms, and other main street businesses across the U.S. will be forced to close in the coming month after Republicans in the Senate recently blocked a $48 billion package to provide relief to owners who have struggled to stay afloat during the coronavirus pandemic. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Nearly 90,000 Small Businesses in U.S. Expected to Close After Senate GOP Kills Main Street Relief Bill. Here's the story. Advocates for independently owned businesses warn that restaurants, gyms, and other main street businesses across the U.S. will be forced to close in the coming months after Republicans in the Senate recently blocked a $48 billion package to provide relief to owners who have struggled to stay afloat during the coronavirus pandemic. The Bipartisan Small Business COVID Relief Act, which was meant to replenish the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, RRF, passed last year, was co-sponsored by Senator Roger Wicker, but still failed to get more than five Republican senators to support it. The vast majority of GOP lawmakers claim that helping locally owned restaurants to stay open and continue employing people in their communities would worsen inflation and contribute to the deficit, with Senator Ron Paul saying on the Senate floor that dumping more money in the economy is simply pouring $5 a gallon gas on an already out-of-control fire. As a result, said Erika Polmar of the Independent Restaurant Coalition, we estimate more than half of the 177,300 restaurants waiting for an RRF grant will close in the next few months. The bill would have given $40 billion to the independent restaurants left out of the restaurant relief program, which passed last year but ran out of funds in just 3 weeks, with only one in three applicants receiving grants. Polmar said local restaurants across the U.S. expected help, but the Senate couldn't finish the job. Neighborhood restaurants nationwide have held out hope for this program, selling their homes, cashing out retirement funds, or taking personal loans in an effort to keep their employees working. The RRF bill would also have given $2 billion for gyms and fitness centers, $2 billion for live event companies, $2 billion for bus and ferry operators, $1.4 billion for companies near border crossings, which have shut down during the pandemic, and $500 million for minor league sports teams. The Community Gyms Coalition told The Hill that although an RRF replenishment bill passed in the House, the Senate failed to invest in fitness and exercise, despite their obvious benefits for Americans' mental and physical health. After hanging on for another year, hurting restaurants throughout the United States, especially in rural communities, may not see any relief despite the House passing a bill just last month to put more money into the RRF, said Didier Trin, Policy and Political Impact Director for Main Street Alliance, MSA. The fate of these small businesses, including ones owned by women and people of color that were left behind, will be tied to those senators who voted down this lifeline today. Along with Wicker, Senators Lisa Murkowski, Roni Blunt, Susan Collins, and Bill Cassidy were the only Republicans who joined Democrats in voting for the bill. The Democrats needed at least 10 Republicans to support the legislation to reach 60 votes required by the legislative filibuster. MSA tweeted, senators who ensured this fate instead of providing the relief small business needs now must be held accountable. Tyler Akin, a board member of the IRC and a chef in Wilmington, Delaware, noted that the GOP's rejection of the bill immediately followed a vote approving $40 billion of military and humanitarian aid for Ukraine, more than $7 billion than President Joe Biden had requested. Ironically, this filibuster followed a vote to stand in solidarity at a similar level of funding with a group of European allies that handled some of the worst effects of the past 2 years with far more grace and unity, Akin told the Philadelphia Inquirer, adding, "It's clear that those who aligned with Senator Pat Toomey today have little or no desire to support small businesses."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Congo, treasure island in the heart of Africa.
Part 1.
On August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its east rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. June 30, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. In the ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa. Rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond, and in most cases, there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. He had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes. So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence-seeking among millions of the Congolese people. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo, which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office. A decision that the Prime Minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him
as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu.
Joseph Mobutu.
Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history. Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the UN session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the UN. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then UN Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu. The Prime Minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off. Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government. Patrice Lumumba delivered speeches to the people in most of the cities and villages in his escape to the north to inform them about the facts behind the developments in the Congo. CIA agents followed Lumumba all throughout the way. They were looking for a suitable place where the coup army could arrest him. On December the 1st, 1960, as the Prime Minister was crossing the Sankuru River with his family, the spies announced that the time was ripe for his arrest. As Lumumba's boat approached the shore, forces loyal to the coup leader Mobutu got into the boat. Lumumba was taken to the capital aboard a plane, but those who accompanied him forgot that he was the Prime Minister until just a few days ago. Patrice Lumumba arrived at the airport of Leopold, which was full of reporters. They showed the Prime Minister to the public in a very humiliating and offensive way, a move which was planned to tarnish his charismatic image. His wife and children were witnesses to what was happening at the airport some meters away. Lumumba, along with two of his cabinet ministers, Maurice Ampolo and Joseph Okito, were sent to the state of Katanga to be executed. Moise Tshombe, Lumumba's archenemy, was looking forward to receiving his guest. On June 17, 1961, the Katanga government, led by Moise Tshombe and supported by Belgian advisors, decided that Patrice Lumumba and his two accompanying ministers should be executed. At around 8:30 p.m., the prisoners were taken to a place in the depth of a remote forest to be executed. Moise Tshombe was present in the place along with his ministers. The soldiers shot Lumumba and his companions dead and then rolled their bodies into a ditch. The coup government spread a rumor in an attempt to answer to the public opinion. The rumor was that Lumumba had escaped in a stolen car and was later arrested and killed by local people. However, the people of the Congo never believed this official account of the incident. The true story about the abduction and execution of Lumumba was leaked after several years. But Lumumba's body could also be highly problematic. He was so popular that the discovery of his body could put his murderers into trouble. Therefore, they decided to exhume and destroy the bodies. The mission was delegated to a Belgian officer called Gerard Sote. They returned to the place where the bodies had been buried. They exhumed the bodies and after drinking a lot of alcohol, they dismembered the bodies and dissolved them in sulfuric acid. After years of conflict and civil war, Joseph Mobutu wrested full control over the Congo in 1965. After that, Mobutu, who called himself Mobutu Sese Seko, ruled over the Congo for 32 years with an iron fist. He even changed the name of the Congo to Zaire. With Mobutu's seizing of power, the U.S. had found a puppet government in the heart of the strategic continent of Africa for three decades.
Well, Zaire is among America's oldest friends, and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends. The entire continent of Africa. And we are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you, sir.
Mobutu was one of the world's wealthiest men until 1997, with a fortune estimated as much as $5 billion, while the Congo's population of 40 million had been degraded to one of the world's poorest nations. Mobutu was ousted from power in 1997 by Laurent Kabila, a leader of one of the main rebel groups. He later died of cancer in Morocco. During the civil wars that ensued Mobutu's fall, some 5.5 million of the Congolese people were killed, while millions of others were displaced. 9 African countries and 20 militia groups were involved in the wars, which are remembered as the African World War. Civil war, violence, disease, hunger and poverty were the legacy of the colonialist rule of Belgian King Leopold II, as well as the involvement of the White House rulers in overthrowing the only democratically elected and popular government in this green land. Although in 2002 the Belgian government apologized to the Congolese people for the involvement of its forces in deposing and killing Patrice Lumumba, the U.S. government has yet to apologize for architecting and launching the Congo coup and contributing to Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
In the limelight.
The shock came midway through the speech. Reparation, boomed Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's firebrand president, to the cheers of farmers, working students who had gathered in the crowd. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Constant Mahout, Catherine Porter, Salam Gebrekidan, and Matt Apuzzo. The piece is titled, A Haitian President Tried to Hold France to Account for Its Years of Exploitation. He soon found himself ousted from power. The shock came midway through the speech. Reparation, boomed Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's firebrand president, to the cheers of the farmers, workers and students who had gathered in the crowd. The French ambassador to Haiti, sitting on stage, hid his alarm behind an awkward smile. He knew Mr. Aristide well enough to expect barbs at Haiti's former French colonizers and slave masters. But on that day, on 7th of April 2003, the president suddenly started calling for reparations, a bombshell that became a hallmark of his presidency, and diplomats now concede part of his undoing. We had to try to defuse it, the French ambassador to Haiti, Yves Goudoul, said of Mr. Aristide's call for reparations, calling it an explosive. With his remarks, Jean-Bertrand Aristide tried to excavate a history that remains all but buried in France. Long after Haitians threw off their shackles, beat Napoleon's forces and won their independence 2 centuries ago, France came back with warships and an unheard-of demand that the people of Haiti pay astounding amounts of money to their former slave masters or face war again. Haiti became the first and only nation in the world to pay reparations to its former slave masters and their descendants for generations. According to a New York Times analysis of thousands of pages of archival documents, it shipped the equivalent of hundreds of millions of dollars to France, setting off a cycle of perpetual debt that sapped Haiti's ability to build a nation for more than 100 years. Yet, to this day, that history is not taught in French schools, and many of the country's most prominent aristocratic families are unaware that their ancestors kept collecting payments from Haiti's poorest people long after the end of slavery in Haiti. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's first democratically elected president after decades of dictatorship, wanted France to do far more than acknowledge its past. He wanted restitutions from Paris. What beautiful schools, universities and hospitals we'll be able to build for our children, he told the crowd. How much food we will have in abundance. The consequences were immediate and lasting. In interviews, a dozen French and Haitian political figures recounted how a worried France worked quickly and doggedly to stifle Jean-Bertrand Aristide's call for reparations before siding with his opponents and collaborating with the United States to remove Aristide from power. France and the United States have long said that Jean-Bertrand Aristide's call for restitution had nothing to do with his ouster, that he had taken an autocratic turn, lost control of the country, and was spirited into exile to prevent Haiti, already heaving with turmoil, from careening into chaos. But France's ambassador to Haiti at the time, Thierry Burkhard, conceded in an interview that France and the United States had effectively orchestrated a coup d'etat against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and that his abrupt removal from power was probably a bit about his call for reparations from France as well. It made our job easier to dismiss the reparations claim without Jean-Bertrand Aristide in office, Thierry Burkhard noted. The showdown underscores how, 2 centuries after France forced the Haitians to pay their former slave masters for the liberty they had already won in battle, the effects continue to ripple through the politics of both countries. By calling for restitution, Haiti, a nation born from what historians called the world's most successful slave rebellion, struck at France's national identity as a beacon of human rights and threatened to inspire other nations with historical grievances against France to follow its lead, nations in the Caribbean and in Africa. "We were very disdainful of Haiti," the French ambassador Yves Godwell recalled. "What I think we will never forgive Haiti for, deep down, is that it is the country that beat us." Even after Jean-Bertrand Aristide's removal of power in 2004, the calls for restitution have continued to reverberate, leading to a stunning concession more than a decade later by François Hollande, France's former president, who referred to the money Haiti was forced to hand over as ransom of independence. Since then, scholars have increasingly explored the history of Haiti's payments. Just this past December, at a conference on the grounds of the French Finance Ministry, one of the most prominent French historians on relations between the two countries, Jean-François Brière, called the payments a form of meta-slavery that prevented Haiti from breaking free of France long after independence. "All French people are affected by the nation's past in Haiti," said Jean-Marc Ayrault, a former French prime minister. Yet, Ayrault said, "French students don't learn about it and few officials discuss it. It's never taught in France," he said. "It's never explained." Mr. Yves Godwell, France's former ambassador to Haiti, wanted to negotiate. Jean-Bertrand Aristide's sudden call for restitution was a political hand grenade, he feared, threatening to embarrass France on the world stage and rip apart relations between the two countries. Yet, Jean-Bertrand Aristide's stance was not unreasonable, he recalled thinking. He wasn't wrong to say how much harm it had done to his country, Mr. Goodwill said of France's history in Haiti, and to ask France for compensation in turn. The former French ambassador to Haiti, Yves Goodwill, said he urged the French government at the time to open discussions with Haiti to help defuse the situation, but was firmly rejected. I didn't understand how we could be so stupid, Mr. Goodwill said. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a polarizing figure who rose to office as a champion of the poor, knew his campaign was contentious and had timed it for maximal impact. He announced his demand on the 200th anniversary of the death of Toussaint Louverture, the Haitian revolutionary leader seized by Napoleon Bonaparte's forces and carted off to prison in France, where he died without a trial. Why, after 200 years, is Haiti this impoverished? Jean-Bertrand Aristide said in a recent interview at his home in a suburb of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. One of the reasons, he said, was the enormous amount of money that Haiti has been forced to hand over